This hour is brought to you by Design First Builders. Visit designfirstbuilders.com.
MLB analyst Craig Calcaterra, author of the Cup of Coffee newsletter.
If you own the Chicago Cubs, you're making more money off of real estate than you're making off of the gate. And the gate then doesn't really matter so much. People are going to come whether they lose, whether they win. If fewer come when they lose, it doesn't matter. You're still making money. If you own a baseball team and you don't care if they win or lose, if you don't have that weird George Steinbrenner kind of thing in which you just passionately want to use them as your sort of chess piece to help you feel better about yourself. We used to make fun of that with owners like people like him and Ted Turner, but that inspires a baseball owner to want to make his team better. These days, that isn't there as much. I'm sure they like to win. I'm sure it's good ego gratification for Mark Walter to pick up the World Series trophy when the Dodgers won it last year, but it doesn't really affect his bottom line if they don't. And that's a huge problem in baseball, having that disconnect between good product on the field and financial success.
Craig Calcaterra with Bernstein and Rahimi on 670 The Score.
Let's talk some baseball with Craig Calcaterra. He writes the Cup of Coffee newsletter that starts my baseball day and beyond every single morning with recaps and larger thoughts in long form at Substack. So do subscribe. Craig Calcaterra is with us. Hello, sir.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. And I think you're the perfect person to ask about our previous topic of discussion, and that is why for all objective reasoning, a series between the Rays and the White Sox, the two best teams in the American League, would garner a whole lot more attention that it just doesn't. No one really seems to care as much as they probably should. What is it about these teams or their histories or anything that makes that the case?
I think a lot of it is sort of a self-fulfilling kind of thing by the networks and by the baseball media. Tampa Bay is a small market and they're an anonymous team, so we're not going to cover them, but they're going to remain an anonymous team in a small market because they don't get the kind of coverage. I really think it's a Rays issue more than anything else. It's very hard to find a face of the Tampa Bay Rays. It's very hard to market them as one of the best teams in baseball, even though they have been one of the best teams in baseball over the last several years. So I think that just flows from there. If it's, you know, I mean, we still see the Yankees and the Red Sox playing on Sunday nights and getting all kinds of hype, even though the Yankees kind of stink and the Red Sox are, better this year, but kind of transitional.
Well, the Red Sox right now are one of the teams notably that people are watching when it comes to their spin rate. The crackdown is beginning. I didn't want to get into this this early. When you mentioned the Sox, the red ones anyway, that might be a team that is greatly affected and will see the AL East settle even more, perhaps in the Rays' favor.
Yeah, there are a couple of teams that are sort of thought of as the hotbed of this. I think everyone does it, to be clear. I don't know that there's any team. I doubt there's any team that doesn't have at least a few pitchers on it that are using foreign substances, whether they are extreme or relatively minor. Red Sox have been talked about as one. The Dodgers have certainly been talked about as one. One guy who, you know, gets mentioned sometimes, Nathan Eovaldi, he's been mentioned as a user. He had a great performance. So if he stopped using, then, hey, he did okay last night. But we have all kinds of uncertainty about this going forward.
Speaking about the Red Sox, you wrote something pithy that I think deserves some attention. And it's something that I think we should keep pinned up to remind ourselves as each day we come in here. And, you know, we do this job every day and there's always a game. And we have to fight the tendency to want to ride the roller coaster and sort of find trends in a given game or a given moment with understanding now we're back to the 162. Here's what you wrote. This is regarding the Red Sox beating the Blue Jays. Winning 2-1 the day after giving up 8 homers and losing 18-4 is baseball in a nutshell. It's the reason you never get too worked up about a regular season loss or too pumped up about a regular season win. It's the reason why baseball is the best sport for the even-keeled and non-excitable among us. It just is. And just being is a wonderful thing. That's kind of a zen thought about how we consume baseball.
Someone told me this morning, one of the commenters said that's why baseball's demographics skew older, because only an old fart like me can think of things like that. And there's probably some truth to that. I mean, I do sort of feel like I miss out on some of the, go excitement that some of my younger friends and colleagues have when it comes to a baseball game. But no, that's why I love baseball. That's just – what I love about it, I used to watch football all the time. I used to watch boxing all the time. I still watch basketball once in a while, and it's great and it's exciting, but there's something really nice about lower stakes. And while things get really pitched in the postseason, of course, and while we get really excited during opening day and things like that, as the season goes on, no one game matters. And there's something really nice about that. It's terrible for radio. I'm sure you guys know that. It's like bad talk radio if it doesn't matter, because that's the whole point. But it's what I love about it. If my team is losing and they're just playing ugly, I turn it off. I go do something else. I don't care, because there's a new game tomorrow. That's what makes baseball great to me.
Some of us who like to test our artery strength still try to enjoy the dramatic swings of it. Going back to that Rays team, one of the things that I thought about watching the game was how, unlike the Cubs, they could afford to lose Blake Snell and still contend in this division. The development of their pitching is still elite. Fireisen, I hadn't gotten a good look at him until the game last night. Two very solid innings of work. Dominant, arguably. How do you describe the talent that they've developed and just the scouting that they do to get to this point for them?
It's got to be the system. And if they have a secret sauce to it, they haven't shared it with anybody. But just the sheer depth that the Rays have with their pitching. And I'm not talking about the top end. I mean, Blake Snell obviously was a Cy Young winner for them. Tyler Glasnow, unfortunately, who left last night with an injury, he might be out a little bit. We're going to see how deep they really are. Those guys are elite aces. We know that. Rich Hill obviously has been an ace in the past and is making a very late career, bit of a renaissance this year. But I'm talking just the normal dudes, like, you know, Andrew Kittredge, Ryan Thompson, guys like that, who just every year they have several of these pitchers who come up and are able to give them great innings. And that's why, unlike a lot of other teams, when they have their bullpen day every couple of days, they don't fall off at all. And it doesn't hurt them down the line. And if the roster rules were sort of like they were a few years ago, when teams like the Dodgers used to take advantage of them and shuttle pitchers in and out constantly, they might even be better, which is kind of scary. But there's another side to that, too. It's great and it's effective. But the other side of that, that's kind of what makes them faceless in the way that I talked about at the outset. It's very strange to get excited about a game when six pitchers come in and dominate. It's still a good overall performance, but you don't have anybody that you can hang that on. And I think that kind of makes the Rays sort of, you know, unapproachable in certain ways and hard to warm to if you're not already a Tampa Bay Rays fan. It's like a late period Steely Dan album. Like, only the real heads are into it.
Oh, that's the metaphor I did not see coming, and I'm absolutely here for it without question.
I said I was an old man. Come on.
The way you have framed the sticky stuff crackdown as primarily passive aggressive, I think is dead on. But the aggressiveness is in how unilaterally this is being done, where instead of inviting the union in and saying, hey, how can we all want this done, how can we do this together? They're not. And they may be using it as a rattling of the saber before things really begin in earnest, using it like a cudgel to say, look, we're doing this and you're going to figure it out. And they went through all of their usual spokes reporters and Nightingale and Passan, et cetera, yesterday afternoon and evening, rolling it all out. So I'm wondering now, if you're on the player's side, is there a response? Is there something that you feel that is a proper response or strategy from the union side to make sure this doesn't affect your negotiation going forward, regardless of how this is enforced on in this current level?
Well, there's at least one justifiable structural reason for why MLB is sort of pursuing it in a unilateral way. And that's because since it's an existing rule and they're merely going to start enforcing it again, they don't have to talk to anybody about it. And that's easier, right? If they were going to start building in things that what people think they should do is allow a couple of substances, not allow other things and all that. But that requires big negotiation. I agree that a big reason they're doing that is they now want to create a new issue for negotiation purposes during the collective bargaining sessions that are just beginning, are going to go into earnest this fall and winter. When the union then has on its plate something it wants badly, which is a relaxation of what appears to be a pretty strict rule, that means they want something. MLB doesn't want anything, and that means they have to give up something. That's how the negotiation works. So the cynical among us, and yeah, I'm one of them, thinks that part of the way they're doing this is they're doing it in order to make negotiations harder for the union in the fall. The problem is the players really don't have anything they could do about it, at least right now. There is no ability for the union to step up and say, hey, stop, you are enforcing the rule improperly. Now, if they start suspending people arbitrarily, if it seems like people are being targeted, but others aren't, and there's uneven enforcement, there might be a mechanism for them to, you know, file grievances and things. But that's a long, slow process. And I think, I hate to say it, but I think the way the league is handling it is kind of brilliant in that they're doing suspensions, but with pay. Generally, a unpaid suspension is something that's going to immediately get an appeal, but a with pay suspension, the stakes are a little bit lower. Arbitrators might be more willing to side with the league. It's handled, deftly by the league, even if it's not handled the way that anyone would really like them to.
That was one of the pieces of information that when it came out, I was the most piqued by, was trying to separate why they would suspend players with pay for something that they deem publicly so egregious, that they're willing to stop down games, that they're willing to have this whole sweeping policy, that they actually want to fix a problem and they deem it one. But the suspension with pay piece, I think, is critical here.
Yeah, and it, you know, in some ways that ends up being the balance ends up being a harsher penalty on the team because the player's not, if you're a starting pitcher, what, you miss one start? And someone else pointed this out to me too. This is not a bad way to think about it. If you can gamble if you're a starting pitcher, right? Say you're going to make 30 starts this year. You think, I could probably get away with it except for maybe twice. So I'll make 28 starts using foreign substances and have an ERA of 2.80 as opposed to 30 clean starts with an ERA of 4.2. Which one are you going to do?
You can pick and choose your spot. You can pick and choose your spot. Like, say you're facing a team that you know you fare well against, but if you're a reliever, that's where the concern comes in.
Well, it's also, if you're not even in the major leagues yet, this, I keep thinking about this. It's one thing if you're already here or you've got a contract, you're worried about your next contract. What if you're a guy at Double A who has been in pitch lab because the Edgertronic cameras had you move a finger over on a seam? You've been tracking your spin rate, you know, in Arizona with every pitch that you throw in every side session that you do. And a lot of this is based on what you can generate using something. I mean, I'm really wondering how much turmoil the developmental structure of some of these teams is experiencing right now.
Oh, and they know it, too. There was a report either yesterday or over the weekend that this was earlier in the season. I remember because you remember before the season began, the league said it's going to start watching spin rates as a way of trying to suspect who is using substances. There was a report that teams began having pitchers not use them in development and things like that, so they can get a baseline spin rate or something. It's like gaming the system from the minor leagues on. And it's really a mess. This reminds me of the steroid situation in a lot of ways. You know, physically, it's not as much of a burden to these guys, of course. There's not a danger in this, but the pressures are still there. You're a marginal guy, and do I use the stuff that everybody else is using? Do I not use it or risk losing my job? It makes it really hard. And if Major League Baseball's enforcement is, as I suspect it's going to be, kind of like we said, passive aggressive or arbitrary or something like that, you don't know what you're supposed to do because there might still be a lot of guys using it, and it might be the difference between you making a big league roster or not. So just the same kind of problems we've had with any kind of rule breaking in baseball.
Well, and the umpires play into this too, but I'm immediately concerned about the teams affected. I mentioned the Red Sox. The Cubs are among the bullpen leaders in ERA. And I can't help but wonder, given all of their upstart talent, how they're going to be affected by this.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. I don't think we really have any idea. And some people were floating numbers early this week about how since the beginning of June, ERAs have gone up and batting numbers have gone up. But I don't even think you can go based on that because there's some other work out there and other research out there showing that it always ticks up in June. I don't think we have a clue of what's going to happen. I think you're certainly going to see more walks because it's a matter of control, right? I mean, if you can control where the pitch goes, you're going to be in the zone more. So you're going to see more walks. You're probably going to see more hit batsmen. You're certainly going to see guys with get me over pitches that lose a couple of ticks on the gun, because you know you can grip it and rip it a lot more confidently if you're using spider tack. But if you're not, you might slow it down a little bit to have better control. So I think we're certainly going to see an uptick in offensive numbers. It'll be really curious to see who is affected the most out of this. I think it's certainly going to be hard throwers, guys with good four-seam fastballs, and guys with very sharp breaking stuff. Relievers, more than anybody else, probably are going to take it on the chin.
And as Joe Sheehan pointed out, crunching some of the math in his newsletter yesterday, saying that June, you usually get an offensive uptick anyway, that this is a time where you see a bump, and that takes out the entire variable of a changing baseball, which we know is possible, that if we start seeing more runs on contact, more success on contact, that very much could be MLB rolling out some lot numbers that they know are a little more slippery or a little more bouncy, and they can control for some of that. But what I don't want to get into, if we're going to compare it to what happened with the steroid era, that became just kind of gross and tedious after a while, where it was part of our job. Remember the spring when Bagwell and I-Rod, and they all showed up like 30 pounds less than they were before, and they all had the same talking points of, oh, my trainer wants me to be more flexible with more range of motion, right? And it was like the opposite of best shape of their life. Like, wait a second, your face is all weird, and what's going on? This is going to happen now because of data. Like, we could go to Baseball Savant and say, oh, this guy, this guy, this guy. Somebody's going to be able to set up an algorithm to immediately send alerts to his phone just to start flagging people, because we're not guessing. It's not the eye test. It's data.
Yep. And the thing is, this is what Major League Baseball wants, too. They want us, and how do you not, but they want us to start singling out guys. They want us to say, so-and-so a pitcher obviously is the guy who benefited the most from this. And this other guy, he clearly was a rosin and sunscreen fraud or something. Baseball loves it when the conversation is about players doing bad as opposed to an enforcement mechanism or an entire structural problem existing. That's what they did with steroids. That's what they did with cocaine. That's what they did with gambling. That's what they've done with everything. It's never a Major League Baseball problem. It's never a systemic problem as far as the league is concerned. Let's name some guys who are the bad eggs and then say we cleaned everything up. That's what's going to happen here. And we're going to go along and help them do it.
We bought the factory that makes the baseballs. Don't worry about that. Look at this guy. And now for something.
Major League Baseball, they actually switched, as Joe Sheehan mentioned in yesterday's newsletter, in the middle of the 2015 season, it is very, very clear. They just switched baseballs in the middle of the season. We don't know that they're not doing that now.
They bought the factory that makes the baseballs. We just keep repeating it. But also, the funniest part of your newsletter was pointing out the obvious. Why do the Toronto Blue Jays have a 4th of July hat?
I love Major League Baseball. I love New Era. I wear New Era hats all the time. There's the MLB logo on the Blue Jays cap has the red, white, and blue on it. It has the 4th of July, the whole thing stripes on the Blue Jay. You know, last I checked, Canada wasn't the United States, and they don't celebrate it. And I've got a Canadian reader who told me we don't even celebrate Canada Day, which is July 1st. They don't even celebrate that the same way we do the 4th of July. It's just not as big a thing. So very strange. I know they're playing in Buffalo. I know they played in Florida. Haven't played in Canada since 2019. But come on, man. Don't make them be Americans. There's plenty of us already.
If we're smart as fans, we're buying every single one of those hats and wearing them in America, because that is hilarious.
If they make a Yankees cap with a maple leaf on it, I'll buy it.
Well, let's not forget the double maple leaf hat
that
they had for those clipart hats. I forget what the names of them were. Local market hat?
Yeah, local market mistake on purpose to get attention hat, yes.
They're going to be all in the big landfill with all those ET games for the Atari 2600.
No, they're gonna send them to impoverished countries. Oh. Like the 8-year-olds in the diamond mines are all gonna be wearing those hats along with like the Bears
1993 Phoenix Suns NBA champion.
Yeah, Bears Super Bowl champion 07. Yeah.
No, gentlemen, stop playing checkers. I'm playing chess over here. Americans have got to buy out those hats. Period.
Do we get subsidized health care?
Maybe we get poutine.
That's next best thing. Craig, thank you, sir. Appreciate it as always.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Craig.
That is Craig Calcaterra of the Cup of Coffee newsletter. You found something that is going to make us happy as Bears fans. And it's one of these things, now, if I just remind myself, the Bears have Justin Fields, it makes me feel good. It's like saying Jim Boylan is still fired.
The next clip of audio is going to fire you up to the point where you might be mad that it's not training camp. That's next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
He's been awesome so far. Great teammate, great person. Comes into work every day, you know, with his head down and ready to do the right thing, you know. So he's coming out here every day to be great, and you can see that. And he's learning from everyone and everything that happens. So he's been awesome to get to know and be able to play with on the field.
Bears tight end Cole Kmet on the most exciting person in Chicago sports at the moment, Justin Fields.
You were into it. Yeah, then you're
No, I'm just wondering. I mean, I talk out of my ass all the time. I didn't want to say that without like thinking a little bit. But he's like the most intriguing single figure in all of Chicago sports. It's always it's a young, exciting, athletic Bears quarterback. I want to mention too, by the way, don't forget we have Cubs tickets to give away today.
DJ Airhorn.
Before the end of the show. We're going to give away a four-pack of tickets to see the Cubs and the Miami Marlins at Wrigley this Sunday, June 20th. It is a four-pack of tickets that we will have for you, so this could be at any time for the queue to call, so make sure you're listening.
Yeah, somebody's got to yell at the Marlins. Remember how they eliminated the Cubs out of playoff contention last year? Somebody's got to do it. It's got to be you guys.
Did you hear somebody yell at Jason Hayward last night, get the shot?
I was busy listening to other trash talk about the guy in the Sox game who said, I'm not ready to go home yet.
That's good.
Like, there are still like people yelling in audible field mics, and I do enjoy it. Speaking of enjoying things, Dan Bernstein.
Yes.
I have really liked so far. I think the morning show is 2 for 2 on fill-in hosts for David Haw. James Fegan, hilarious. And then Tom Thayer. Just casually mentioning in the pick six yesterday morning about how Justin Fields' athleticism is going to change the shape of the defense. I'm so excited. I'm smiling talking about it. Let's take a listen to Tom Thayer talking about Justin Fields.
And what is the most underrated quality of the Bears' rookie quarterback? I think can't deny his athleticism and how it'll affect the opponent's defense. If he's the type of guy that runs a couple of really efficient RPOs, if he gets an overzealous backside defensive end and takes advantage of him, he will change the entire backside of the defenses because of his athleticism. Now when you have two defenders, they're coming at an angle in pursuit of a less athletic quarterback, you're going to see the backside defenders kind of staying in position and opening up holes in the interior of the offensive line because they have to respect what he can do to you. And if you make yourself vulnerable, he is going to make you pay. So the more mentally fit he becomes to run this system and just being able to react to the play that he calls in the huddle and not to be thinking about him, you know, he can change the way defenses have to play against him because of, you know, the determining factors of why he was drafted where he was and the type of athleticism that he shows up with on the field. It could be difficult for overzealous defenses to try to take advantage of him.
Ooh, yeah.
Doesn't that feel good?
Yeah, and the music makes it feel even better too. We didn't add that. That's they have that in there as part of the segment.
No, actually, but anytime you talk about Justin Fields with bravado, NFL Films music just comes.
It plays
in
automatically.
And then somewhere, Tom Fasenda says, "The autumn wind is a Raider."
The frozen tundra. Yeah, that just there's the
yes. If only we could mash up Tom Thayer talking about Justin Fields over this.
Oh, I'm sure we could, but we'd have to strip out the other music. But what I love about that analysis is he does a deft job of combining the mental with the physical, where he notes that the key to it is after having called the play of being able to feel the play. And we use a lot of euphemisms for that. We talk about the game slowing down or being in the moment. We've had every quarterback's coach on this show that Justin Fields has ever worked with along the way talking about some of these things. And that is why there's so much trust that we have to have. We have no choice. We have to trust that Matt Nagy and John DeFilippo and Bill Lazor are going to know when that's there. they're going to know, because that's it. That's the spark. That's when it comes together, is when he can take what's on the whiteboard. He can take what the words that come out of his mouth, that he's using all these flashcards, and then in the moment feel when that defender's off balance, or when something he sees in front of him means that safety is 3 yards away from where he's supposed to be because he's hedging, because he's worried. And now you got a receiver who's about to put his hand up in the air, but the ball is there before the receiver even does it.
It's also the idea that when we talk about a team becoming one-dimensional, or we're seeing a play form the way it does after the snap, that so much is built in pre-snap that we forget about these layers. We forget about the idea of defenses changing shape, not just because of a guy like Allen Robinson. Shout out Allen Robinson, who's supposedly at camp today. But the idea being that these threats are something that a team has to respect and build in for. And so now you will have openings because they have to be all over the field in ways they weren't in the previous offensive setup with either Foles or Trubisky.
Speaking of Robinson real quick, today marks 1 month until the contract extension deadline pursuant to the franchise tag rules.
July 15th. This was the date that we were keying in on.
So there has been no real negotiation. I mean, both sides are sort of set, and it's going to take some movement. And usually deadlines drive negotiation. I don't know historically if it's the 1 month or if it's the 1 week when stuff actually happens. I'm sure there would be proposals ready to be exchanged if there is some kind of movement. But at the moment, it's just it's all status quo.
History would dictate that they're not going to do anything else, correct?
I guess.
We spent weeks, months, telling the Bears to pay Allen Robinson and sign him to the deal that he deserves before he had a quarterback of this talent level. And here we are.
It's not without risk for him. You can get insurance against catastrophic injury, but that still doesn't fully compensate you for what you could miss out on. So he has to think about that. There is pressure that he could have. It's sort of, you know, bird in the hand and takes the injury issue off the table for him. But look, you're Allen Robinson. You're going to bet on yourself. You're going to get paid. You've put up these ridiculous numbers. You become an elite NFL wide receiver despite having mostly bum quarterbacks your whole career.
Nobody reports on insurance policies. We report on contracts because that's how dudes get paid. And Allen Robinson deserves it. I'll say it again. I really hope to see it this season. Like, whatever proof you need, and I don't think you need any more, it's going to happen this year.
And I think it, when you start talking about the cap situation, wouldn't it help? Like, wouldn't they be able to structure it in a way where they actually could, with the multiple years and average annual value and spreading out a bonus, you get a benefit vis-a-vis the cap?
If you restructure, if Darnell Mooney, by the time he was singled out in that one press conference, isn't your number one receiver, I don't think he will be. But also, they know they're getting Robinson at a bargain because he is one of the league's best wide receivers. Isn't he?
Yes.
So then, even with the franchise tag, they're still getting him perhaps at a relative bargain.
I think his current number puts him ninth. I think it's probably about right. He's a top 10 wide receiver in the league, no matter how you slice it.
The numbers say so.
Yeah.
If you look at Pro Football Focus, they certainly agree. He was their top free agent once he momentarily became one. And then the Bears put the franchise tag on him. But he, of course, would say, I think he wants to get a contract because he deserves one. And being concerned about injuries for him is legitimate. That's fair.
He's already had an ACL. Well, you get to a certain age, some of these things become more likely. So we'll see. I'm hopeful that there will be some detente between the sides and an agreement will be reached, and he'll be around for a while.
He's there. He's recording videos. He seems happy to be there. We know the man's a professional and he can produce. Let's rock. Oh, that's right. It's June 15th. Okay.
We love Allen Robinson. He's a great player for us, Jason. We know that.
That's Layla Rahimi. I'm Dan Bernstein. The Midday Midway is coming up. Remember that whale of a tale I told you yesterday about the guy who was swallowed by the humpback and thought he was going to die and then was with the whale zoomed up and spat him out? Yeah. About that.
There's more?
Yeah. There's an update.
Love triangles get even weirder. This story's one to discuss. That's next.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
The first half or the second half, you know, it's they're two equal times.
Now, Midway.
The Midday Midway.
One. Put two and two together.
Midway. The most important of the year.
Possibly four. It's four or five or three, but.
Most exciting thing on the Midway.
Five or
six, seven, eight.
Our objective is Midway.
Nine, ten.
You guys gotta meet me halfway out there.
So real, you can almost feel.
The Midday Midway with Bernstein and Rahimi. Middays 9 a.m. to noon on The Score.
Here in the Midday Midway, we let you know what we already discussed. We talked some White Sox, heard from Lance Lynn, basically saying everybody chill out, and Craig Calcaterra did the same as we tried to make heads or tails of what's happening with the sticky substances, or lack thereof. Some X and O porn from Tom Thayer talking about Justin Fields and athleticism and what he can do to a defense and what they are trying to do. And also, I mentioned that before the end of the show, we have tickets to give away, a four-pack of tickets to see the Cubs and the Marlins on Sunday. We will do that in the next, I don't know, 73 minutes or so.
All right. This is a headline that was shared by one Carol Roth, who you know, Dan, mm-hmm. because somehow Dan knows everybody. A New York socialite slash ex-model left her restaurateur husband for her twin sister's husband.
Whoa.
There's a lot of loyalties broken there. I don't normally deal in the gossip, but this is a weird one to me. So, twins, models, fashion, restaurants, betrayals, and some sort of husband switcheroo. I'm not quite sure how this happened exactly, but yes. Apparently, a New York socialite by the name of Charlotte Bonstrom, she's a Swedish-born former model, was married to Vittorio Ossoff, who owns Serafina, which is a pretty popular restaurant in New York. They've been together for more than 20 years and have two kids. Her identical twin sister is Cecilia Bonstrom, also a former model, and her husband was Thierry Guillet, who's founder of the fashion house Zadig & Voltaire, where Cecilia, his wife, is a creative director. They also have children together, a 7-year-old son, and then three other kids from previous relationships.
Jeez.
During the pandemic, Charlotte had an affair with Cecilia's husband, Thierry. And now the two cheaters want to get married. Her sister, as you can imagine, is devastated. And Thierry clearly has a type. And there's a rumor going around.
Well, if they're identical twins, I would say that suggests that there's a particular, very specific type.
Oh, that's right. It's the person who looks exactly like the other person because they're twins. There's a rumor going around that Cecilia is going after Charlotte's jilted husband, Vittorio, as an act of revenge. This is all a little too linear for me.
Who's following this and reporting on it and cataloging all of it?
Well, clearly it's delisted, and it was also Page Six who's shocked by that. Vittorio confirmed to Page Six that his wife is cheating, but denied anything was going on with him and his sister-in-law. A likely story, guy! A source confirmed the drama to Page Six, though, saying that it broke the good twin sister's heart. Poor Cecilia was betrayed both by her husband and her twin sister. What do you do if you're that person?
Start a new life? You got enough money? I don't know, move
you
somewhere?
You can't, can you?
Take some kids and head out to rural Idaho and set up a compound.
I don't think socialites and creative houses or creative directors of fashion houses do that sort of thing,
yeah,
do
like,
they?
Like, does this... I don't know the rules on this stuff. Because now she can't hang out at, like, the same places or restaurants or bars. Like, she needs a whole new social circle.
When it's your family and your twin sister at that's a level of betrayal that is just up there.
Yeah, that sucks.
Loyalty is hard to find, but you think you can at least find it with the person you shared the womb with.
No good! Well, we're on the New York Post. They also published this. Something's fishy. At least one doctor at the Cape Cod Hospital that treated the lobsterman who claims... Is it lobsterman or lobsterman?
Both.
Well, like the superhero would be Lobster Man, but if you catch lobster, you're a lobsterman, right? It's like the it's like,
and you're like a really good superhero until somebody puts like rubber bands on your hands and you're done.
You're like, damn it!
Can't get near any of those.
Foiled again. My kryptonite is actually rubber bands.
You also can't walk near any grocery store.
Well, that it was in Friends when Chandler was reading a comic, and Phoebe walks by and says, like, oh, I see you're reading Spider-Man.
Yes.
And he says, no, it's not Spider-Man. It's Spider-Man. He is a Spider-Man. It's not like his name is Phil Spider-Man.
Right? I love that bit.
So the lobsterman, who claims he was nearly swallowed by a humpback, according to the doctors, have expressed skepticism about this whale of a tale.
Oh.
He reportedly, if you actually fact check him, he reportedly ascended from a 45-foot depth in 20 to 40 seconds. And didn't have any evidence of barotrauma, scoffed the Cape Cod Hospital emergency room doc.
What is barotrauma?
Barotrauma, also known as the bends in some cases. It can be, well, the bends is an extreme form of it when nitrogen in your blood actually boils if you come up too fast from a great depth, or, as some people have experienced, if you scuba dive on the same day you fly,
Ugh. You
can get the bends when your plane reaches a certain altitude.
Is that the second Radiohead reference we've had today?
No, okay. But that actually happened to a friend of mine who wasn't told and went scuba diving and came up too fast. So a person traumatized by such an encounter should expect more serious injuries, such as hearing loss, because of the sudden change in water pressure from that depth, noted the physician. Michael Packard, 57, was released from Cape Cod Hospital Friday afternoon, just hours after the incident, miraculously suffering only soft tissue damage and no broken bones or other serious injuries. Packard could not be reached for comment. Other people in the industry, in the fishing industry, were skeptical. People who know whales are finding it hard to believe, but this is the first time I had heard it explained in quite this way of barotrauma, of moving either way up in the water column and out of the water column or down at a rapid rate is extremely dangerous. And he didn't seem to suffer any ill effects. So maybe calling BS on this one, or WS.
I think it was just a knee-jerk, cancel culture kind of reaction.
And to everybody making jokes about whale tails, yes, they still exist. You know the ones we're talking about, because low-rise jeans are supposedly coming back soon. Every other bad trend.
I think this is a reference I don't know, because whale tails for me is a drinking game.
Yeah, unfortunately for people of a certain age, it is a combination of bad skivvy placement with women on purpose.
Vis-a-vis
their jeans around the years 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005
oh, yeah.
Or so.
Oh, I never minded that.
Well, of course not.
No, that's kind of hot.
Oh, no.
But for us, it was the drinking game. Whales, tails, Prince of Wales, Prince counts six, tails on two, no who six, no who four. You ever play that game?
No.
If there's six of you, like, in a circle, and there's a whole rhythm to it, and it's you count clockwise or counterclockwise, depending on the rules of the game, from the speaker. And if I say, Prince counts six, tails on two, that would mean the person two away from me is tagged. And then there's things you say, no, who, and the response is who, and then that person says five. And then it goes back to five away from him in the count, and then whoever screws up drinks.
Seems like a lot of work for a drink.
That's the point of drinking games.
So,
and then there's the meta games and the side betting that goes on. And then if you screw up twice in a row without somebody else screwing up, it means flags are up. And if flags are up on you and you screw up a third time, then there's some agreed upon horrible thing you have to do or consume. And I don't know. That was college.
This is a piece of work that I need to study. Not on this show.
You never played Zoom Schwartz Perfigliano either?
I'm sorry, what?
Zoom Schwartz Perfigliano.
No, we just cracked open cans of beers and called like Wednesday.
Everybody know you can't be the only person that ever played Zoom Schwartz. You're all sitting in a circle or standing in a circle, and as you turn your head to the left, you say Zoom, and that passes the ball to the next person. That person can say Zoom and look at the person to his or her left, and it can keep going. And if you say Schwartz, it sends it back the other direction. The proverbial ball moves back the other way. If you say Perfigliano, that's a Zoom with a head fake. That means you're staring at the person serving to you as if you're saying Schwartz, but you're actually passing it through the back of your head to the person to your left.
That's complicated.
You are a huge nerd.
Also, to Twitch, I said okay computer earlier today in a meeting. Then Dan's talking about the bends. That's where Radiohead comes in. The end.
Dan is playing drinking parlor games from the 1800s like he's in a Dickens novel. No!
Thank God. Somebody finally said it.
Classic 80s, late 80s, early 90s college games where everyone is Brett Kavanaugh. Now, then when we used to get high on the bong called Capitol Hill, the bong had this big dome in the middle and was known as Capitol Hill. And with all the public policy majors and political science majors at Duke, I was not one. But you could only smoke using parliamentary procedure, where you had to have a quorum. There had to be motions need to be seconded. There had to be cloture. There were markups and everything. Everything was done in parliamentary procedure when you went to Capitol Hill.
This is 100% taking the fun out of something.
But that's kind of what we did, I guess. I come by it honestly, maybe.
It's funny. It's clever, but tedious.
Area code 815, Mark from Montana here. My bum of the week would be Dan Bernstein for being all over Rizzo and Hayward. He has no idea what either man has chosen, whether they've gotten vaccinated or not along that line. So... Dan Bernstein. This is all the way from the state of Montana.
Where
it's a vote for Bum of the Week.
You are a bum.
Well, we actually know exactly what they chose because they said so.
Don't worry about that. Apparently they don't have all of the internet in Montana, just some of it.
Just some of it. That's okay. It's all they need.
Mark call, because he was clearly just talking. This guy from Montana says, Dan should not make judgments about, that's your thought, Les. Own it.
Kenny Owens from the Grange Park.
Core tails.
Whale's tails.
That's Midday Midway. And next up, the expert in baseball cheating and skullduggery, the man who literally wrote the history book on it. Larceny and Old Leather, our old friend Eldon Ham. All of our baseball guests are also lawyers today. I guess that's just how we roll. He's going to join us next to talk about baseball and where this kind of fits historically, what they're doing, and what we can learn maybe from history. He's next on The Score.